I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. Hagsploitation, psycho-bitty horror, grand dame guignol. The rush to make movies with past-their-prime starlets who suddenly go off the rails in violent ways is attributed to 1962's Whatever Happened to Baby Jane's release and subsequent box office-busting, headline-grabbing, Oscar-winning run. But when you think about it, there's been hints of this genre throughout film history. Think about delusional Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard. So when Whatever Happened to Baby Jane came out and did what it did, the release slate for movies was suddenly full of imitators, including ones that cast Bette and Joan individually and were also directed by Aldrich. By 1971, you'd think the genre would be all played out. And you would be wrong. Okay, let's get into this genre, which just so happens to be one of my favorites. Cam, Alicia, why were they still getting made by the 70s, and why don't we have more movies today where our James Caan equivalent torments our Olivia de Havilland equivalent who's trapped in an elevator? Because that movie is messed up.
We do have an equivalent before, wow, like we get into the past, which I know Cam has some really great data.
Yeah.
Isabelle Huppert starred in a film called Greta in 2018, yes, directed by none other than Neil Jordan. And that is the closest throwback to a psycho bitty film. And I want to encourage everyone to see this film. It's a little bit different because Isabelle Huppert has never diminished or faded away. She has been
a class act straight through.
Maybe more famous than ever.
Like straight through and sophisticated. And so watching her go full berserk in Greta, which was never advertised as a psycho bitty film, very enjoyable.
Yeah. It was a very odd film because you kind of went in thinking that it was maybe
gonna be
a little
house French thriller, and it was like, no, it's not. Someone's locked in a coffin.
No.
Real trashy. Yeah, it's weirdly close to one of the films we're talking about. But yeah, it kind of goes back to what some of our previous episodes this season have been about, which I think it's the changeover between the old star system and the new star system, and the fact that we have not quite yet gotten those new Hollywood stars. So I think an interesting thing, as bad as, you know, as cruel as the studio system was, what it did was essentially mint a series of people to be lifelong celebrities. So it had worked so hard, the marketing machine had worked so hard, that it kind of did two things, where number one, these people were just so famous, world famous, forever, until the day they died, or chose to essentially retire
from public
life.
They just want to be left alone, I get it,
Yeah, exactly. They either, or they did something terrible, or, you know, decided to be openly gay or something. That's like the two ways. But the interesting thing is that it both did that, and I think it produced a group of people who also demanded to be stars. You know, they did not want to be treated as less than. A lot of the people, I think, from that era thought that there was stars and there was character actors, and it didn't matter how old you were a star. So there's kind of a thing, like, if you think, you know, as much as the kind of quality of the films changed and the style of the films changed, these films are still star vehicles that probably paid fairly well. Like, as embarrassing as, like, Trug is a Joan Crawford movie starring Joan Crawford above the title. And, like, Joan Crawford is the draw. Like, I couldn't tell you who else is in Trug. I don't know. She's not even the main character, but it's like, yeah. So I think that there's something there that, number one, you had these actors. Number two, I think that all of these exploitation people, though we're going to be talking about one that weirdly is kind of like, it was an exploitation movie, but was sold and produced not really as one. But I think the exploitation people, especially your Cormans and your Arcos, knew that you could sell something on the back of X or Y. And you hear with some of these films, that they were very picky about who, what old person would sell and what old person wouldn't sell.
There was definitely a canon of like a cadre, if you will, of old biddy actresses. And I think more to your point, Cam, and I love everything that you're saying, is it's important for listeners to realize the difference between celebrity culture in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and today. Like today, there, you know, we can go on Instagram and see the accounts of actresses and actors, just performers in general, that we know from the 80s that have kind of retired, and we're very much in their lives still. But if you think about it,
we can see what Kurt Russell had for breakfast. Like, that's what's
and
going
I
on.
Do constantly. I mean, I love following Kurt Russell and Goldie, and like, you know, they're still working, but you get an idea of their private lives because they're in control. Whereas in the 50s, 60s, 70s, leading into the 80s, you know, you of course had tabloids that were constantly trying to sell a photograph of Greta Garbo after she went into hiding, but it was a much different era. And so really the way that you would engage with these monumental stars, and we're not just talking about stars, but like people who basically formed Hollywood, who made the Hollywood machine what it is, especially someone like Joan Crawford, who was there from the silent era into, you know, sound, and was really one of the biggest stars of all time. This was really the primary way you could engage with seeing the wrinkles and seeing their bodies change, or in the case of like Joan and Betty, never change, which was came with its own medical issues. Yes. And of course, you know, we have a show called Feud, which is a Ryan Murphy show. That was the first season of it. I think they're doing a second season. But there's a lot. So there's a lot of background on these films that has been recently covered in a television show. But that's how people got to see them, is through these movies. And that's, I think, why the posters for both the films we're going to talk about, and really all the posters from the Psycho Biddy era, are really spoiler alerty. Like, they show the last sequence, the last scene, the last frame of the film, the shocking ending. And they're also so front and center with, like, these are the actors that you know from the classic era, and if you were young and into horror, your parents knew them, and they were collecting fan magazines with Debbie Reynolds on the cover, and, well, not Shelley Winters, but certainly Joan and Betty. And
there are some Shelley Winter fans out there.
Shelley was, in terms of her star persona, very different than someone like Betty and Joan. And keep in mind, Shelley Winters was a two-time Oscar winner at this point in when she made both of these films, and would go on again to win to be nominated for an Oscar just a year later in 72 with Poseidon Adventure. So I mean, she was really an esteemed actress. We know her as the grandmother from Roseanne, and I love her as the grandmother from Roseanne.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Ryan Murphy, because he's someone who really has picked up the Psycho Biddy tradition, bringing us back Jessica Lange and Kathy Bates and Angela Bassett, and like these women their careers had sort of diminished in a way, and then they come roaring back in these really fun, out there, especially the Coven season of American Horror Story is a great showcase for those women.
Yeah. Jessica Lange is a great example to me. You know, she's very on par with someone like Isabelle Huppert, who is really tongue-in-cheek with her career and somehow still extremely relevant to a really young demographic who has probably never seen, you know, Tootsie or the films that really made her a star.
Yeah. And I mean, Jessica Lange is kind of fascinating too, because like I always think in that movie Hush from 1998, she was already kind of a Psycho Biddy. So it's like, she just keeps coming back. But yeah, I also think the other thing to think of is just, there is such diminished opportunities, and now as well, but especially back then, for actresses of a certain age, and especially stars who wanted to star of a certain age. And I mean, you hear, the interesting thing you hear about Shelley Winters is she obviously, I mean, she was like a blonde, busty actress in the 30s and 40s, but she hated those roles. She hated the boring kind of ingenue roles. So she kind of got labeled a difficult woman because she didn't want the major studio roles. She like famously, you know, walked into auditions without makeup and stuff to be like, treat me like a real actor.
Could explain why she's drowned in almost all of her films, like A Place in the Sun, drowned. Night of the Hunter, drowned.
Drowned. Like, Poseidon Adventure, drowned.
Yeah, true. I didn't think of that. Yeah, and I think that there's just a huge appeal, and Debbie Reynolds talks about it, and you would never think that Debbie Reynolds would be like a horror movie, but like people got this script passed around, and she said it landed on her, and it's the best role that anyone had offered her in years. So she was, like, obsessed.
All right, well, that's the perfect place for us to get into this first film. So as we mentioned, this, of course, is the reinvigoration of careers. And you know what? There's a delight that comes along with it. Is one of my favorites is back. And as you mentioned, Debbie Reynolds has this fantastic sense of humor about herself, but her career was one that really didn't lull. She was coming out of a sitcom, and she got producer influence, which is partially how this film got made, which is kind of interesting. But nonetheless, here she is in 1971, mixing it up with an actress who didn't have the best reputation for on-set behavior, Shelley Winters. And oh boy, we've just started to scratch the surface about Shelley Winters. Now, this wasn't a departure for Shelley in terms of movies. In 1970, she'd played Ma Barker in the brutal Bloody Mama, so audiences were ready to see her get nasty. And Shelley is in both of our movies today, but this one, Cam, you introduced to us. You even mentioned it last season, and it is perhaps...
God, it's so
the greatest camp premise I think I've ever heard, and I was delighted by this. Tell us about What's the Matter with Helen?
Well, yeah, What's the Matter with Helen is essentially like a gay man's brain exploded all over the screen, because it's like, so What's the Matter with Helen? It's actually, I think, for a Psycho Bitty movie, it's a bit more of a noir plot. It's an interesting film. It was developed by Henry Farrell, the writer of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and Curtis Harrington, the director, that kind of worked on it together. And Harrington suggested this early 1930s setting, and also suggested aging up the actors. It was originally kind of a two younger women role. But what makes this movie unique in the Psycho Bitty genre, I think, is this is a story of two mothers. They're two women who whose sons commit a murder, and it is so high profile that they're threatened, and they end up leaving town from the Midwest to go to Hollywood to reinvent themselves, and they choose to do so via a dance school for essentially creating the next Shirley Temple, which is a very weird
but
and
did
specific
exist
idea.
From our episode from Day of the Locust, back in season two. This was such a phenomenon this takes place in the mid-30s, such a phenomenon along Hollywood Boulevard is these ridiculous dance schools for kids and star-making camps for children.
I mean, I love it. And you read much creepier accounts. This is actually a pretty charming dance school where they do seem to legitimately be trying to make the children stars. But
pretty good. And Debbie can dance.
They're not bad. They're not bad. Yes, exactly. Yeah, she's not lying. But anyway, so when they get there, the plot essentially goes two ways. Shelley Winters' character, Helen, becomes more and more like religiously obsessed, becomes obsessed with an evangelist, an Amy Semple McPherson type, on the
played
radio.
Played by Agnes Moorehead.
Wonderfully. A wonderful one-scene turn from Agnes
very
Moorehead.
Small. Yeah.
Debbie Reynolds ends up falling for a father, a kind of Texas oil man, of one of her students, and she essentially struggles with will she reveal the truth of what her life is, that she has this son that's in jail for murder. And along the way, Helen thinks they're being threatened. She thinks there's people in the wings and is something happening, and there may be some murders and there may be terrible things and menacing gay elocution men and stuff like that. Yeah.
Who's just a red herring.
I mean, as we said, if you are just listening to this and have never seen anything about this movie, I suggest you go see the movie. We will probably spoil it. The poster is famously a spoiler. I was very lucky to see this film on Turner Classic Movies, where they were like, don't look at the poster, don't look at anything, just watch the movie right now. So that's kind of what I say. It's a very interesting take on the genre, but yeah, we'll probably spoil everything because whatever.
I think it's worth noting that Debbie Reynolds was 38 years old. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth noting because
Shelley Winters is like 50.
Turning 38 next month, and that now means that I can be officially a psycho Debbie. I am over the hill.
Well, when you look at the original women that were approached to do this, they were looking at Shirley MacLaine and Joanne
Woodward. Who were very
young. Right?
Yes.
And Shirley MacLaine, very young at that point. But that's, to Cam's point, they were looking at younger women and then decided to age them up somewhat.
And I think this is the one where he also, what we're talking about, to go back to Alicia's point, the way people were shielded, I believe they approached Rita Hayworth And that's when they found out she had Alzheimer's, and nobody had told They went for a full meeting.
That's actually
it's a really sad story, but it's kind of fascinating because you would never know she'd just retreated from public life, and even nobody told them. They went for a full meeting with her before they realized she had Alzheimer's. But anyway, it's kind of a fascinating film because he was trying to develop it. He had a great reputation with Universal after Games because people really loved that movie. But
and that's the one with Simone Signoret as the psychobiddy.
And James Caan. It's a lot of fun. So he had a great reputation, but it kind of fell apart, and this script seemed pretty toxic. I think people saw it as more exploitation. And it was only Debbie Reynolds who super loved it. And as you said, she was coming off of a sitcom that kind of didn't work, but part of her sitcom deal was to produce a movie. So this movie ends up getting produced, interestingly, by Filmways, which is mostly a TV production company, but does some kind of more extreme films. But I don't think that they necessarily were ready for such an exploitation picture.
Yeah.
And they were a little... You hear about a lot of producer headbutting, even though Curtis Harrington considers this his best movie and his most personal film.
Yeah, and as much as they're very much a television output, in no way does this feel like a TV movie. Like for the most part, I think the look of the film and all of the mise-en-scène is really well done. Coming back to Debbie, I was interested when I read that, one, she's uncredited. So she did produce this film, but it's uncredited. They didn't want her name on the front end of it. They just wanted her to be the star, pure and simple. But she is going through her own mental breakdown, mental health crisis while on set. This is not that long after, if you think about it, the Eddie Fisher, Liz Taylor.
Sure.
And if we were to talk about Hollywood scandals, very few are bigger than that one.
Yeah.
So I think we forget about that 50 years later, that was Debbie Reynolds' life.
I totally did. You're illuminating me.
Carrie Fisher, her daughter at this point is about 10, I think, or maybe 14. I can't remember. But
if I can just quickly, if you're interested in this and you don't know the story, go watch Carrie Fisher's Wishful Drinking, where she has a literal flow chart where she breaks down on whether or not her daughter is committing incest by dating like another Hollywood star's child. It's amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, she was the queen of the headlines of the tabloids.
Sure.
And so I think that makes it really interesting to exploit her star power for a film like this. And then given the personal background that she is having her own mental health crisis in a film where more her like partner, the character Shelley Winters is playing, is having a real meltdown. I mean, the film is called What's the Matter with Helen?
Yes.
it's so much so much simmering in the background of this film that it doesn't matter if you don't know this information because it's still such an enjoyable film. But when you bring in the extra textual, which I think is true of a lot of psychobiddy films, like the reason Baby Jane is so fun is because everyone knew that these two actresses had hated each other since 1931. Like, the psychobiddy genre is really about having a star that you know all their dirty secrets, you know how many marriages they've had, you know, and then playing that up and then playing, you know, against type where you're de-glamorizing them. You're putting them in a wheelchair. You're putting them, you know, on poverty row. You're putting them, you know, at a like rinky tink.
In the case of this one, you're making the millennials. Yeah.
Or you're making them look like a psychotic Jean Harlow that's like too blonde, too perfect. But actually, you know what? This actually connects so well. I'm glad you brought this up because I totally didn't think of it. And it connects so well to what I think is very interesting about this in the canon of psychobiddies, which is that they're mothers, because most psychobiddies are pathetically not mothers and tend to be a little obsessed with children and like creepy, as we'll get into in Auntie Rue. But I think that that's a fascinating point because you're seeing two different kinds of mothers. And Helen, her problem is she takes it all too much on herself. She blames herself that her son did these murders. And the problem with Adele, Debbie Reynolds' character, is she takes no blame. And and they kind of paint her as the worst character because she completely cuts off her son and tries to remake her life and pretend that nothing happened. And even Shelley Winters has this wonderful speech where she's like, that woman they killed was us. She was our age. She looked like us.
Yeah.
They're trying to kill us.
She was a working woman just like us, about the same age. Looked quite a bit like us. So our sons really wanted to kill us. They hated us. That was the substitute revenge.
And that's so shaking. But it's wonderful that you say that because obviously Debbie Reynolds probably, she was like one of the most famous kind of single mothers in Hollywood.
Yep.
She probably had a real reputation as this, you know, cold woman who didn't need a man and was out on her own. So you kind of see that in the Adele character, and they're absolutely playing up.
And if we're going to talk about cold mothers, I mean, who's the queen of them? Joan Crawford, who is, you know, one of the actresses. Just really, I think if we have to pick one actress, even over Bette Davis, she is the Psycho Betty queen for she did. Straitjacket, my God, Straitjacket is a great film. I was reading, there's a New York Times review in 1968, so just a few years before the films we're talking about, of a film called The Anniversary. And Renata Adler, who always kind of cracks me up, she had to kind of define what the psychobiddy genre was. And so it didn't have the name psychobiddy yet. It didn't have, you know, grand dame, guignol. It didn't have hagsploitation. Those are all terms applied later. She referred to it as the terrifying older actress filicidal mummy genre. which hits all the films. Filicidal meaning a parent who intentionally murders their child. I mean, that doesn't happen here necessarily, but it's not far off.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of fascinating because, like you say, this is a genre that is kind of stitched together, and we're really at what is kind of the tail end of the boom. As you say, there's still Greta, there's still Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker, which Becky and I love. And I mean, you can also go back to, like, obviously, like, Lady Havisham is like the original psychobiddy. It's in literature. It's this kind of interesting thing because I don't think even while making it, people are necessarily thinking these are connected, but this film is kind of interestingly connected because of Harrington loving the author and going for the author. And he made two adaptations of the author's work, including How Awful About Alan, which is a TV movie that Becky watched a bit of. It's crazy. It's fun.
It's worth your time. It's Anthony Perkins.
Anthony Perkins and the psychobiddy, gosh, I can't remember her name. It's his sister, but she's a bit of a kind of a classic character too. So I think it's very interesting. And the other thing that works so well is Harrington is obsessed with character actors and actresses of a certain age. And I think just elderly people. He's kind of an interesting guy where you can tell that he never loved his own performances, but he makes this House of Usher film when he is a very old man who I think had already suffered a stroke. And I think he's like, finally, I can be what I want.
The Usher thing, though, and I could be wrong, so I know it was released in the 80s, but that's his first film.
So he remade it. When he was 14, and then in 2002, I think, he made a remake of The House of Usher with him as an old man.
Got it. Okay, How Awful About Alan psychobiddy is Julie Harris.
There you go, yes. And there she's wonderful in it, And I think he has this interesting care, not only about those people, but like if you hear him talk about any of these movies, he's talking about Agnes Moorehead is huge, but he's talking about like Yvette Vickers, like people who show up for one scene and he's like, oh, I was so in love with having Molly Dodd come on set. And it's like all of the, you know, the ladies who come in and you look, actually, these two movies we're going to talk about are kind of his peak in a lot of quality and studio involvement. So a lot of his other movies reuse the same actors from like Night Tide and his more independent films.
And so, Night Tide had Dennis Hopper in it, right? Hopper.
Yes. Yeah. Because I mean, he's we might talk about a little more going forward is he was a big experimental filmmaker, so he had a lot of clout. He is one of the like James Whale hangers-on, so he knew. Knew everybody.
He was a consultant on Gods and Monsters.
Yes,
wasn't
he?
I mean, he also was a hanger-outer with Orson Welles.
Sure.
Kind of interesting. So, I mean,
I want to be clear. I really love this. I think it's a lot of fun. I'm going to go back and probably watch it again for Halloween. But I really wish it was made a few years later. They had to cut a lot of stuff for content because we're still on that cusp of like, they don't want to be too risky. It's still a studio movie. Mm-hmm. They're still like, we can't make her an outright lesbian. We just kind of have to hint at it. And they were, there's a moment in the film where Shelley Winters was really pushing for a kiss on the mouth, and supposedly it was filmed. If the film is out there, I want that restored, because man, that would really change the movie. And talk about groundbreaking for 1971. And then even the scene where, spoiler alert, Debbie Reynolds is stabbed to death, they wanted like a full psycho moment where it was like brutal, and that doesn't happen. Unfortunately, you get this like weird thing
apparently filmed too, and I think that's the unfortunate thing where this, because this film is produced by Filmways and not somebody like AIP and Arkoff, I don't know that they would have been comfortable with lesbianism, but they would have been comfortable with the violence. So I think Filmways was kind of trying to split the difference. And mm-hmm. there's an unfortunate thing, which is nice but bad, but like Harrington calls himself, or he said people called him the modern day George Cukor, and he's like, not because of the quality of my films, but because I was so nice to work with, and I was so good at working with people who are a problem.
Yeah, I mean, so, but also they're gay. Like, I mean, yes, George Cukor is probably one of the most famous, you know, queer directors working in a studio film. I mean, there is some debate whether he was gay or not, I think, but I think we are.
Oh yeah, I think both of those guys are pretty. But yeah, but I guess so. The thing is he often compromised, and he just thought it was part of the business. Yeah. And yeah, it's unfortunate. Like he loves this movie. It's worth saying he loves this movie. He loves the final product, in spite of the fact that it cut this violence out. He'll be the first to say it cut this violence out. It cut this gay overtone. Not even there's plenty of undertones in it. But he also apparently I found a little information that this film is not very much in his style. Like if you watch his other movies, you kind of get to know his style, which is very dreamy and very surreal. And apparently this film involves a lot of dissolves, which he was not allowed to use. Hmm. It's a pretty classically cut film, but so it probably had a little bit more of a dreamy style, which isn't there, but it's fine, you know. It's still a great movie.
Yeah, I could see it also having more of a style that is hearkening back to the 1930s films of Hollywood,
sure.
right? Which had dissolves and things like that. And we do get a lot of performances. There's a little girl at the recital who performs Nasty Man from George White's Scandals of 1934.
Yes, so good.
May I point out that is Robbie Morgan, who would go on to be a scream queen in Friday the 13th movies. Which is very funny. But she's great. Like, it's very weird, but she's great in it.
Yeah.
Like, she does it very well. Yeah.
Yep. No, she's amazing.
It's an interesting thing because I also think, like, having the benefit of seeing all of Curtis Harrington's films nowadays, a lot of people pin this movie as being like, well, Debbie Reynolds made it. Debbie Reynolds forced in all these performances and forced in all these dances. But Curtis Harrington has singing and dancing in all of his films.
Yeah.
Every horror movie stops for a long dance sequence because I think he just loves
it. And honestly, I think the movie works better for it.
And it's also such a cornerstone. It's a cornerstone of the psychobiddy, because if I think about, you know, and I can barely count on two hands the iconic moments in Whatever Happened, Baby Jane. Mm. What's the most iconic one? Betty Davis as an old lady performing that song. Like, it's
that's true.
I've written
the
letter to daddy. Yes.
Yeah, there's people who have never seen that film and they know that song. And Betty Davis, she had some roles where she was a chorus girl or dancer, very few in comparison to Crawford. But, you know, he was even putting dance and music sequences with actresses who were certainly like Olivia de Havilland, like who were not like Joan Crawford's of the 1930s and 40s.
Well, I want to get us into the relationship between Debbie Reynolds and Shelley Winters, because Shelley Winters wasn't originally approached for this. She was invited by Debbie Reynolds. You mentioned that Debbie Reynolds was going through mental health crisis. So was Shelley Winters. She was having a really big, difficult time during this, so much so that she was having trouble getting to set. So Debbie Reynolds would have to go pick her up in the mornings. And one morning she found her on the highway in her nightgown trying to hitch rides. And when she picked her up, she was like, oh, I thought I was late, so I was trying to get there. It's like, oh my god, that's just difficult.
No, I love it. Did you see there's a great promotional quote where, like, obviously it's so weird, like, we're talking about the fact that the poster spoils everything, but in all promotions they spoil the whole movie too. But there's a great Debbie Reynolds one where she's like, in this film, I get stabbed to death by Shelley Winters, and I'm just hoping I don't get stabbed to death by Shelley Winters on set, which is like...
Oh, my God.
Because the reason why Shelley decided to do it was she got sent the script because she had just written a play for Broadway. Mm. This sort of like Broadway
starred
playwriting
premiere. Robert De Niro,
And she's
crazy.
Like, you know, Bob. Exactly. And she didn't want to... Originally, she didn't want to be in town to see how it was received. Yeah. And then eventually, she changed her mind, being like, why am I not in town? It's my play! Because it's Shelley Winters. Even in the interview that says for this thing, even before she went to make it, she's like, I'm gonna go, I get to kill Debbie Reynolds, it's gonna be great.
It's very
just like,
it makes sense though. Wouldn't you want to see the film more knowing that there's like these famous actresses murdering each other, like, and you know, it doesn't happen in Baby Jane. Lots of people die, but you know, Jane and I can't remember Joan Crawford's
name. I can't remember
name.
It
doesn't matter. Blanche, you are in the chair, Blanche,
yes.
But you are.
Blanche, you are, yes.
Blanche and Baby Jane, they don't die. Like, although she's very dehydrated on that beach in the end. Spoiler alert. Sorry, I would want to, knowing one of these ladies dies, right up front on the poster, in the publicity materials. I completely understand why producers did that. It's annoying to us today, but it must have equaled some box office.
Bump. And you're right, Becky, that all of these films have, and some of them even overstated. Like, at least this has a shot from the movie. Like, I think even our next film has, it's like, well, that's not really what happens in the movie.
True.
But yeah, the other thing that is, of course, a joke is, like, even Curtis Harrington makes a joke about it, and all the reviews do. It's like, what's the matter with Helen? She's crazy. She's crazy from minute one. Like, She's the most twitchy, insane woman of all time.
You know what line I love from her that really early in the film painted her character for me? They're talking about movies and, you know, Debbie Reynolds' character, Adele, is obsessed with film and fan magazines. And basically, she brings up a movie, I can't remember which one, something with Jean Harlow. And Helen answers, oh, I've only seen one movie in the last 5 years, and that's Sign of the Cross. And I'm like, yeah, that's who that is. That makes sense.
I mean, she is so good in this movie. It's worth saying. Apparently she was a handful on set, but Harrington loved the performance. She loved the performance. I mean, there's great interviews where she's like, I mean, I guess you could interpret it either way, but I think I was pretty clearly being a lesbian.
She pushed for it. Yeah. She was pissed it wasn't more overt. She was the one who pushed for the on-the-mouth kiss.
I'm going to call it, and this will flow into our conversation for the next film.
Sure.
Shelley Winters is a badass. don't give her enough credit. Like, she was the OG badass.
She did whatever she wanted, which is great.
Yeah, she's just got so much bad reputation, bad woman, bad on set, difficult to work with, bullshit following her, that you forget, oh no, she actually was breaking down.
And as we know, like, most difficult, I mean, obviously she had some mental health struggles, but most difficulty is just women trying to get what they want in Hollywood.
Yeah, but you also add addiction into that. But I would also say what sets her apart from someone like Debbie Reynolds is she didn't have the fuck you money that Debbie Reynolds had. So when you're an actress and, you know, you don't have a lot of financial resources, I mean, this is all actors, you know, it did set her apart, where she's not going to be producing her own film. She didn't have those resources to draw upon. And so she's kind of at the whims of the studio system that's crumbling at that point. But also, luckily, friends with Debbie. I mean, Debbie, I think, did very right by her in this film. And really, I don't know if you'd have Poseidon Adventure without What's the Matter with Helen.
Yeah, her career is kind of interesting because it goes constantly, basically.
Yeah,
and I think that it required that for people to always be like, she isn't quite the Debbie Reynolds seller. But I think that people knew, especially by the 70s, it's like, and she launched, I mean, she ends the Psycho Bitty here, and they're right, she launches the next genre, which recouped all our old actors, which is the disaster genre.
Oh, yeah, Ava Gardner's in that genre.
Everyone sitting on an airplane waiting for it to go down.
or in a building on fire.
Yeah, true.
That's
true.
Right. Towering Inferno. Well, I want to point people towards, if you haven't seen it, please go look at the Debbie Reynolds exercise video, because Shelley Winters is in it. Alicia's favorite Terry Garr is in it. But Shelley Winters shows up wearing a sweatshirt that says, I am doing this for Debbie.
Oh, my God.
She refuses to stop doing, or she refuses to do the exercises like halfway through and just lays there pulling around.
I'm going to Google custom sweatshirt companies and make I'm doing this for Debbie for myself.
It gets better. And then she starts yelling about, so who here has slept with Howard Hughes?
Yeah.
And including Debbie Reynolds puts up her
hand.
Oh,
I was going to say,
like,
if you asked that question in the 70s, you would have an 80% positivity
rate. She talks about sleeping with Marlon Brando. Like, she completely derails
it.
It
is wonderful.
Glorious.
And also, like, you know that essentially she's like, oh, I'm bringing Shelley. She's not going to do the exercises. She's just going to talk. And it's a delight throughout.
But Debbie Reynolds also holds her own, because she's like, I hate doing this, but I like looking good.
Before we move on to the next film, can I just give a little shout out to Debbie? And I feel like this is very well known now, but, like, at a time it wasn't. This woman preserved Hollywood history like no one else. All of these, like, you know, what's that website? Sorry. Like Bustle articles or articles like BuzzFeed about, like, oh my God, they found another pair of ruby red slippers from, you know, Wizard of Oz. Debbie was garbage, like, basically dumpster diving all the MGM sets, like, in this era, 71 would have been big for this, taking all of the things that the studios threw out, personally paying to store them, to like preserve them as best she could with limited resources. And it's a big year for Debbie Reynolds, I think, in 2021 going into 2022, because the Academy Museum is finally opening, which in terms of some of the most important props that they're going to be displaying were rescued by Debbie Reynolds in the 1970s.
I think you are failing to give credit to Planet Hollywood and the franchise of that kind
true.
Of preservation.
Yeah, failing.
Allowing the Days of Thunder car to rot away in front of the Niagara Falls establishment when it was abandoned.
Yeah. Niagara Falls is a real Psycho Bitty location.
Oh my God. Can we make a Psycho Bitty film that takes place on Clifton Hill? Oh my God.
Yes.
True.
And then the last thing I just want to say, because I mentioned we were going to get into it quickly, was we are all big fans of Day of the Locust here, but there are some accusations Curtis Harrington has thrown at John Schlesinger, specifically for the Amy Semper McPherson bit. He says that John Schlesinger stole that from his movie, which I can see.
But
it's an older book.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen in the book. That was added.
It is, but also that was part of Hollywood's 1930s history. That is, Amy Semple McPherson was a real person. Like,
I will say that he is obsessed with Amy Semple McPherson, though. She comes up in many of his films, including Games. And I wonder how much. And I mean, he's obsessed. It's interesting. He says he never saw her. He said his parents went and were like, ugh. Because apparently she was so, the quote he had was, she's like, when I pass around that collection plate, I don't want to hear the jingle of coins, I want to hear the rustle of paper. Which I'm like, oh boy. And he's like, that was in the Depression. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, he loves, he's also a wonderful like old bitch shit talker in all his interviews, which is great. He believes that Alien stole the plot of Queen of Blood, a Russian film he re-edited for Roger Corman.
That doesn't quite work, I think.
No. I don't know. He's a delight, but yes, it's funny that it's in a feud. And these two movies are wonderful compliments. You should watch this and Day of the Locust together. But you're right. They have weirdly similarity. They have the little mop-headed kid that keeps stomping on people.
All right. And with weird little moppets that keep stomping on people, we're going to come back and talk about our next movie. It's Who Slew Auntie Rue, or if you're feeling really proper and British, Whoever Slew Auntie Rue. That's coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In our last movie, the Moppets escaped relatively unscathed from Shelley Winters' Helen. Not so much in our next movie, the delightfully titled Who Slew Auntie Rue? If child endangerment is not something you're okay with seeing in movies, this one is not going to be for you. It does, however, pit Oliver's Mark Lester against, once again, a deeply troubled Shelley Winters, directed by Curtis Harrington. It also features one of the weirdest scenes of apple eating possibly in film history. And I'm including the Laurence Olivier one. So, Cam, Alicia, who slew Auntie Rue? Are either of you wary of women you aren't related to insisting you call them auntie, even though they aren't related to you and you really, really don't want to?
Never had that situation come up.
Really?
But after watching this film, I know how I would handle it. Throw her in the oven. Light her on fire.
I have a lot of good aunties that helped raise me that I like, so I don't know. None of them tried to kill me.
That's good. I've had some good ones too. I mostly did terrible things to them. So.
Yeah, I think we probably share some aunties, to be honest. But
I think we do. Probably. Yes. All right, Alicia, what's this one about?
This is a piss poor retelling of Hansel and Gretel, the iconograph. Yeah, it's it really is kind of Hansel and Gretel. It's not kind of. It is Hansel and Gretel, where the protagonist, little boy, is actually reciting, you know, Grimm's, I think Hansel and Gretel's Grimm's, I will look at there, Grimm's fairy tales. It's very loose. And as much as I'm saying it's Hansel and Gretel, it is devoid of the iconography of, you know, a kind of a gothic fairy tale, which I really enjoyed this film, but it is not, I don't think our listeners would be surprised to find out that this is not on par in terms of quality with Helen. Rue is a little bit more of the made for TV kind of variety, but it is not without its merits. It is really fun, and it's a really fun Christmas film. So, I mean, as someone who likes to collect and disseminate anti-Christmas films, which the horror genre is very good for, this is now in my canon of Black Christmas for sure. If you look it up, sometimes it'll say this film is 1972, but it was actually released in December of 71 with What's the Matter with Helen as specifically a midnight double bill in a few specific Midwest cities in America. So these two were very part and parcel, went together. Absolutely, Shelley Winters and Curtis Harrington's name were what kind of glued them as a pair. And so it's fun to talk about them together on a podcast. But we have Auntie Rue, who is a former kind of vaudeville star who gets married in her past and has a daughter, and the daughter dies tragically by accident. And she goes insane. Her marriage falls apart. She has kept the corpse, the mummified corpse of her daughter, and keeps it in a secret nursery that she gets to through, you know, a secret wall, like one of those bookcases that... You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
and this takes place in the 1920s. And she is kind of the stewardess of a local orphanage and hosts a Christmas party every year. And so two little kids, brother and sister, are not chosen to go to this Christmas party because they're misbehaving. And instead, they sneak away in the car with all the kids who are being driven, the chosen children, to this mansion and just kind of crash. They're party crashers, which I love. These little 6 and 8-year-old party crashers. Yeah. And because the little sister is blonde, she looks a lot like Auntie Rue's dead daughter. And she decides throughout this Christmas party, which is a sleepover, to basically swap out the mummy, the mummified body, and kidnap this little girl and hide her. The little brother is the only person who believes this has happened and then has to break into the house and rescue his sister. And this is where the Hansel and Gretel story kind of comes in, where they really view Shelley Winters' character, Auntie Rue, as a witch. And there's a giant oven in this kitchen where she keeps stoking kind of menacingly. And so he really thinks that she's going to eat them.
She keeps talking about fattening up the little girl. Yeah.
And she is skinny because she's an orphan. So, I mean, and we should say this is, you know, very typical of a Dickensian kind of orphanage. It's a very abusive, horrible place
to live.
This
orphanage is neglectful. It's like, one of the children is missing. Too bad. Yes. Let's go. They'll show up eventually or they won't.
Yes. I'll send her back. Missing within a house. And they're like, whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. And there's this whole element that I really loved that I wanted to see more of like a fake seance of, you know, these fraudster seance where there's a guy who comes in and helps her, a medium, help her talk to her dead daughter. And it's really just they've hired the maid to speak through the dumbwaiter. So it's like this echoey little girl voice.
Darling, come to me, please.
I am trying to come to you. I am here.
And so there's a lot of, you know, Auntie Rue is definitely a villain-esque, but there's also some sympathy for her. And as much as I think I definitely had sympathy for Helen when she goes off the rails in our first film, I was reminded of a very classic film, a film very close to me, which is Addams Family, where you have Morticia reading, I think it's, she's reading Hansel and Gretel to the kindergarten class as a volunteer, and she tells it from like the point of view of the witch. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got that in this film where I kind of saw, like, you know, and she dies, spoiler alert, she dies horrifically. And it's filmed horrifically, and the children are happy.
Bloody good fire.
I'm pretty sure it's meant to imply that the children are maybe just... Because, I mean, the whole thing is they kind of say that the boy has these stories that he's obsessed with that get him into trouble.
Witches,
And you know that he thought that she was fattening them up to kill them, but you see the guy delivering a pig, so it's like she was stoking the fire for the pig. So as much as she is weird and chases him around with a cleaver. She maybe didn't need to burn to death. And
he's also unhealthily obsessed with his sister. Yes, like, he's talking about, you don't do anything without me. Yeah. It's you and me together. That's
because she
is.
Wants
like,
to basically, she just wants her. She doesn't really want the little boy.
Well, why would you?
And that to her discredit, just to, you know, and there is no denying this. I mean, maybe she's not going to eat the children and that was all in his head. There are a lot of scary dolls.
Yes.
And there were some scary dolls in Helen as well, but like the amount that Harrington focuses on the terrifying childhood toys of the 1920s. Wow. Just if dolls are not your thing, this is going to be a real triggering film for you.
Yeah.
The one thing I do have to point out is there isn't a gollywog toy, and this is the UK, so that's good. Great. I appreciate that.
Some taste exercise there,
This fascinating story, I think, like you say, that is set up with all these different kind of pieces, because there's like, she has an evil butler who's in on it with Ralph Richardson, who's the psychic, and they're trying to steal her jewels, and also in the end the kids steal her jewels.
Yeah, so the orphans get this aspect. Like treasure chest of jewels, which I guess they're gonna have to hide in their like mattress on the floor that they sleep on until they're 18.
It depends
when they
on turn how 16? Weird and evil like, they are, I guess. Because there's also like the weird implication that at first they don't speak at all because they've been so terribly traumatized by previous issues. Yeah, I don't know. It's a very strange plot, and I wonder how much so. Like, this is a movie that Shelley Winters got, and then was like, I want Curtis Harrington.
Yeah,
and I wonder if they fiddled a bit because there's all these different screenwriters and. Like an additional dialogue writer and stuff. So it's like, I wonder, it's very British, as you say. I think the shooting style that you talk about that's pretty flat is a very British style.
Yes.
So supposedly Harrington really hated Desmond Dickinson's work as a cinematographer. And I agree with him. I think this would work way better if it was much more gothic-y. It feels a little too TV movie 70s. It's too
they
bright.
They don't play up the haunting of the house, right? Yeah. Like this, you're hearing this little voice of a little girl. Like this is such a great genre that then crosses into the psychobiddy of the haunted house genre that in terms of the cinematography, the set design, art direction, it's just not there. And it could have been hugely improved, like you're saying, Becky, by a little bit less of a cheap set and more of a better soundtrack too, like a creepy sort of, I don't want to say like the Changeling-esque, but the Changeling-esque sound design.
Yeah, which is wild. But yeah, I think if you look, it's actually quite shocking if you look at Harrington's next film, The Killing Kind from 1973, just how different the style is and how much this feels like a film from the 60s and that one feels like a... And this is Arkoff again, so it's like, it's exploitation. But
there's blood.
Like, Killing Kind is 70s exploitation and this is very old-time exploitation.
Yeah, you actively watch a child die in this. That's the part where I was like, oh, I am not sure how I feel about that.
I believe she's impaled.
Is she impaled or does she just break her...
No, I think I saw her fall off the banister, which is something I did as a kid all the time, slide down the banister.
Yeah,
and
I was
gonna somehow
say.
I think she falls on like an iron piece of furniture.
Oh.
Does she? Okay, because I know it happens in slow motion and I was a bit too on that
it's
one.
It's definitely,
to look and,
I think the way this works is in that weird way, the thing we always talk about of like, I think this is a good horror film for kids, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's
yeah,
quite violent. It's worth saying that there is blood and grossness, but I do think if you see it from the eyes of a child, and it's not quite shot like that, like you say, it's not very successful, but I do think it's like, it's not too super scary for an older kid. And also, it's like, from the kid's perspective, that kind of thing, like falling off a banister and breaking your neck is a perfect kind of kid scare.
It's what your parents tell you could
happen. Yeah, exactly. It is going to happen. And you're like, she'd probably break her arm. She had to fall off pretty specifically.
Yeah, it's one story. It's like a half story.
Oh, God.
That's
why
I think she got impaled. But I forgive me, listeners, if my mind is that dark, where I pictured an unnecessary impalement of a child.
You're just having flashbacks to your trauma of Hand That Rocks the Cradle. That's the
also
problem.
Also worth saying, people are always like, Curtis, how did you get into it? And he's like, since I was a child, I loved this stuff. I don't know why. He's like, he always talks about like, he saw the Bride of Frankenstein billboard as a child and was like, but his parents wouldn't let him go to it. So he didn't see it until he was older.
Do you think that Shelley Winters asked to perform the Titwillow scene? Do you think that was her recommendation? Because that just comes out of nowhere and goes on for a long time.
I think it's in keeping with every one of these films has to have a musical, deranged, vaudeville-esque, you know. So much of these films, too, are about old Hollywood. Like, this is the 20s, Helen is the 30s. But really, it's about, because they're taking place in the 70s, and this is kind of always what Cam talks about a lot and talked about early in the episode, which I love, is, you know, they're really reflecting on the old, how far they've come from old Hollywood, right? And so there's a lot of conversation with vaudeville performance, and like Baby Jane obviously is, you know, looking at how two vaudeville children kind of get eaten up in Hollywood. So I think it's probably, I can't imagine she requested that specifically, but I'm sure she was like, I'm down.
You know, just the patheticness of an old show.
Yeah, the perversity of it, right? Like, yeah. So much of this is, these are perverse films about, and I say that as a compliment, about the perversity of stardom and Hollywood and, you know, aging actresses. Hamming it up just makes sense. I mean, the apple scene to me is where, and that could be all in the boy's imagination, the fantasy, the hyperbole of it. But it is like, I'm trying to find a gif. I might have to make my own gif of Shelley Winters eating that apple, because I think I can use that in a number of digital situations.
Sure. I mean, it's a crazy plot too, because it's like, you start off the film thinking that her daughter was involved in a magic trick that her husband did that went awry that made her disappear forever, right?
Why isn't that the
movie? I know. I
mean, there's an almost beheading in this film that I couldn't quite understand.
Yes.
But you're right, Cam. I'd forgot about that part. So I mean, maybe that is what really happened, and the banister scene.
Oh, no. The banister, I think, is what really happened. And I think the other thing is her delusion. Like, I think she just made up.
Because it seems like she ended her relationship with her husband.
Yeah, I think her husband left her because she went crazy.
But it's interesting. She had to keep all of his equipment in her attic.
Yeah. Oh,
everyone
yeah,
needs a storage space. I still have stuff from my mom's garage from when I went to university.
And I mean, it's like, it's interesting because you never really know how much the staff knows about, because you know one of the maids saw the kid crack her neck or whatever. And then, but like, does the butler know that there's a mummy in the house?
Yeah, he does because, yeah, okay. No. Well, maybe he doesn't.
Does he? How much he knows is always a weird thing, because he knows she kidnaps the kid. We should also mention this is played by Michael Gothard, we're going to go with, who's the exorcist in The Devils. This is him playing another
episode.
Bad guy. He is a quintessential bad guy. I don't think we mentioned in The Devils episode, he was a Bond villain, and he's like, he's genuinely creepy and upsetting. And he's creepy and upsetting here, and like, it's a really well-written blackmail scene, too. I thought he plays it very
he's
well.
He's a very body performer.
Unless you give me 2,000 quid, Rosie, I'm going to have to report to the police that you've become a kidnapper. You've got Katie locked in the nursery, haven't you? Haven't you?
Like,
yes.
There's a bodiness to what he's doing, where he's jumping off the screen. And I think it's really, it really works in The Exorcism, but it works in a much quieter film like this.
He takes so much joy in running after those children that
with
it
a
is
cleaver,
like,
yeah, it's pretty
what?
Fun. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and I mean that's the weird thing too. It's like it seems like they're almost more likely to get murdered by this guy than the crazy lady with the mummy, which is a whole weird thing. And I mean, he stuffs his cast like with people like Rosalie Crutchley, who's from The Haunting, who plays the head of the orphanage, and Hugh Griffith, he's the rabbi in Dr. Fives. He's the weird butcher that saves them? Doesn't save them. Anyway, it's a kind of a fascinating thing, because it's hard to tell how much Curtis Harrington had a hand in all of this. And again, you know, T talks about Michael Gothard was a terrible nightmare on set, apparently, as well.
I think Ken Russell said that, too, for The Devils.
Yeah, and again, this is Harrington's deal. He apparently just is like, I can work with the nightmare people, don't worry. I will get a performance out of them.
In his actual quote, he says that he was very pleased to have Shelley Winters. Shelley Winters was really the only person that he had, like, any influence in. He wasn't able to cast anybody else. Oh. Everybody else was just assigned to him, that's why.
That's great, then. I mean, I guess a lot of these guys are Arkoff people too, you know, he had his hand in it. And Shelley Winters wanted Curtis Harrington because she had such a great time on the set where everyone else was miserable because of her.
And this is another fantastic Shelley Winters performance.
Oh,
like,
amazing.
Even if everybody else is doing whatever, like, I think the thing we're talking about, Alicia, where it's like, do you feel sorry for her? Is she a monster? Is she both? Is because of the Shelley Winters performance where you can buy, no, she's both. Like, I feel bad for her and
this
she's a monster.
This would be almost, I would say, unwatchable without her.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm saying it's very watchable. I want to recommend everyone Christmas Day to sit down with their families and watch this film. and make, you know, a turkey, because there's a lot of turkeys in this film, a lot of chopping of turkey heads. And
imagine it's the relative that has bad opinions whose skull you're
crushing. Yeah, a lot of
conversation
on stuffing. Like, there's a really great scene where she's maniacally making stuffing with her hands, which I really love. Yeah, it's a great Christmas iconography is all over this film.
Comparing these two, it's also interesting just to see the subtle difference in performance. And I think you're totally right that this one has a lot more sympathy. Helen is not a very sympathetic character. She's kind of she's meant to trick that thing in your mind where you're like, this is a nice lady, but I want to belt her. and Auntie Rue is just much more pathetic and like sad throughout. Yeah.
She's antiquated. Like, as much as the film takes place in the 20s, she's an old school horror figure, right? Like, she's the dying monster, basically. Well, you know, the new generation of children are just going to light her on fire and move on, basically.
And she...
I've been thinking a lot recently about the more interesting choice in movies. And this is one where they choose. So it's on the lobby card as well, The Mummy. But like, the opening scenes has The Mummy. Yeah. So you know she's got her dead daughter right away. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, is that the more interesting choice? So you set up the suspense of, okay, what's she going to do to these kids and what's she capable of? Or is the more interesting choice you just think she's a pathetic old lady and then she kidnaps a kid, right? Like, what's the more interesting way of taking that story?
It is interesting. And I mean, the Harrington's big touch point is always Edgar Allan Poe. And I do think kind of knowing the corpses may be a bit more of a Poe thing, because you're wondering about if the seances are real or not. That's kind of the trick. But yeah, I think you're right again that the design is what's off here. It should be a much creepier house. And I mean, the thing that's unfortunate is they always talk about the reason why Hansel and Gretel comes up is they call this the gingerbread house.
But it doesn't really look like a gingerbread house.
It has some white trim that could stand in for icing.
Yes.
Well, they are orphans. They perhaps have never actually seen a gingerbread house. They've just heard tell
tales. And maybe
tales,
it doesn't look enough not like a big British house for me to think of it as notable.
Yeah, I mean, this is filmed in this is at Shepperton, right? So it's a UK soundstage, I think, and then maybe some outdoor locations. There's a certain scene where Shelley Winters' character hands out a gingerbread man to every kid, and there's a lot made of the fact that she's American, and so she has to explain that gingerbread men are like an American delicacy. And I was like, there's a weird like British American like confluence here that I find kind of baffling, and we're seeing this a lot in 71 with horror when we were talking about our first episode with Rue Morgue. Certainly, it's just like some of these really kind of bizarre Americanisms in a British film that have to be like explained to British audiences. I find very time capsule-y and interesting.
Sure. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I mean, yeah, the whole movie is just full of these just little moments. Like, obviously, it kind of leads nowhere, but Ralph Richardson doing these seances is a delight.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a strange movie, to say the least.
That I'm recommending. I'm going to say.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. I think we can leave it there. So, Alicia Fletcher, thank you once again for your recommendations and your joie de vivre.
Oh, thanks, Becky. I love Psycho Bitties. I want to see more Psycho Bitties. I want more Isabelle Huppert as a Psycho Bitty. I want to also encourage listeners to think about what actors they would like to see as a biddy, because there's, you know, I love that you brought up American Horror Story with some of the greatest actresses of all time, like Kathy Bates and Jessica Lange, and of course Angela Bassett. But like, let's get more.
I'm waiting for Laura Linney. Whenever Laura Linney wants to take her turn at the X, I'm ready.
Yeah. I was gonna say Goldie Hawn, but Death Becomes Her is basically Psycho Bitties. So
I hadn't thought of that. We know, that's one of my favorite films. Good point.
Yeah,
that's right. Cameron Maitland, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. I would just encourage people to check out more Curtis Harrington stuff. His shorts are usually on Criterion Collection. He started off as an experimental filmmaker, and also, yeah, Night Tide is great. It's in Wright's Hell, so I think it's just available just about anywhere. And his older stuff is a little, actually, I mean, by which I mean newer stuff, I guess, is a little more back in his style. Post Auntie Rue, he gets a little weirder and dreamier in his movies.
Now, Cam, I have to thank you personally, because you're the one who pointed us towards What's the Matter with Helen, and it is glorious. So thank you, as always, for your recommendations on these crazy ones.
I got to thank Robert Osborne for teaching me about it so many years ago in my high school days.
Let's pour one out for Robert. All right. And you can join us next week where we're going to do a little detour from Shocktober into something a little lighter. We're going to look at an animation and a ballet. That's Shinbone Alley and The Tales of Beatrix Potter. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.